Israel Update with Gadi Taub and Mike Duran.
Hello, you're watching or listening to Israel Update, Tablet's prestigious podcast here at the August headquarters of the Hudson Institute. It's Wednesday, April 3rd. I feel like Star Trek, you know, Captain's Log. It's 179 days to the war. And
is it 179?
It's 179.
Did you check it?
I checked it. Oh. Yeah. It'll be 180 tomorrow.
It was just 150, just seems like yesterday.
It's already half a year. And who was it that I heard would say, someone from the security establishment, I think I can't quote them, who said, this war is going to last for years. And by this war, I'm not sure he means only Gaza. He may mean what you and I mean often, that this is not an Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's the beginning of a war with Iran.
I have something to say about that today.
Do you want to say it before the headlines?
No.
Okay.
No, we'll get to it. But I have something to say. I think it's my dumbest take, but we should spend time on it. My dumbest take.
Mm-hmm.
Am I doing the headlines?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. So, Gadi, welcome here at the headquarters. There are two airstrikes by Israel. Well, one airstrike by Israel and one airstrike that the international community attributes to Israel, but Israel has not taken responsibility for, are dominating the headlines. And they were both on Monday. The first one, the most important one, actually, is the one that took place in Damascus. The commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in Syria and Lebanon, his name is General Hassan Madavi, but he's also known as Mohammad Reza Zahedi. He was killed, as I said, the Israelis haven't taken responsibility, but he was killed along with six other people, at least two of whom were Iranian generals and one of whom was his deputy. The Iranian ambassador to Syria, Hossein Akbari, said that Israel would pay for what he described as its crimes. The killing of Madavi / Zahedi takes Israel's war with Iran and Hezbollah to a new height. This is probably the most dangerous development in the war since the war began, in terms of dangers of escalation. And in terms of importance, this is the killing of Madavi / Zahedi is second only to the killing of Qasem Soleimani. And it's the most senior Iranian IRGC figure that Israel has ever killed on its own. You remember Soleimani killed in January 2020. That was an American operation.
But there were operations attributed to Mossad that hit scientists.
Yes. In Tehran. But IRG. This is the most senior IRGC official. Mm-hmm. Good question. I forgot his name. The scientist. He was also an IRGC official, actually. So, okay. Anyway, one of the most senior officials killed by the Israelis. The second strike, of course, is the one in central Gaza that killed seven World Central Kitchen humanitarian workers. In a statement on that incident, President Joe Biden delivered some of the strongest criticism of Israel that he has expressed since the start of the war. He said on Tuesday that he was, quote, outraged and heartbroken by the deaths. In an official statement, he continued, this conflict has been one of the worst in recent memory in terms of how many aid workers have been killed. This is a major reason why distributing humanitarian aid in Gaza has been so difficult, because Israel has not done enough to protect aid workers trying to deliver desperately needed help to civilians. Incidents like yesterday simply should not happen. Israel has also not done enough to protect civilians, unquote. The Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, Gilad Erdan, said on Army Radio this morning, quote, I do not accept the American administration's language, and every one of us can decide on his own why that language is so blunt, unquote. I think maybe you and I will talk about that. In another item, thousands of protesters gathered in Jerusalem yesterday for the third consecutive day of demonstrations demanding that the government act to secure the quote-unquote immediate release of the Israeli hostages, also coupled with a demand for elections. The main event was held outside the Knesset in the early evening. Two groups of demonstrators subsequently set out on marches from the Knesset, one toward the president's residence and the other toward the prime minister's residence. The latter group clashed with police, resulting in 5 arrests. The Shabak director, Ronen Bar, commented this morning on the protests, saying that they represented an unacceptable level of violence. Quote, the images we saw undermine the ability to maintain public order, could lead to violent friction with the security officials, interfere with them doing their job, and even harm protected individuals, he said. He added, a clear line exists between legitimate protest and violent and illegal protest. This is a worrisome trend that could lead to dangerous places that we must not reach. And then one final issue, Gadi, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant clashed yesterday over the Defense Ministry's plans to purchase 2 squadrons of combat planes from the United States.
This is very F-35.
Smotrich sent the Prime Minister a letter informing him that he has, quote, no intention of allowing a ministerial committee to be convened to approve the deal. He argued that, quote, the war has undermined numerous fundamental assumptions about the defense budget and necessitates renewed thinking. The position held by the finance ministry under Smotrich, and my personal position is that the fundamental assumptions need to be either validated or amended, and updated principles and priorities need to be established accordingly, unquote. That's a very interesting development, I think. We'll talk about that too, I hope.
Yeah, it is. There were comments on this on Twitter, and you know the army people protect their autonomy and say that only we will decide what Israeli needs for security, to which people answered, we saw you on October 7th and how much we needed your F-35s. And where the hell were the combat helicopters?
So should we talk about this now? So this is the thing, is they're saying that the security conception focuses too much on the Air Force and its needs and not enough on.
We can. I had an issue with the very detached language you used about the protesters. They tried to break into the Prime Minister's home carrying torches. That is unthinkable in a democracy. This is, you know,
we should point out that my role here in presenting the news is to present the news as the mainstream media presents it, more or less. I mean,
not exactly, because I think we have issue with the mainstream media.
We do.
And how it presents it, but still, no.
I start from that baseline, and then we
continue. But also, you are in charge of balancing the ship here, right?
Yes, I'm also closer to the.
Because if I steer it, it would probably crash.
Well, let's just say that you are more of a revolutionary than I am.
I'm just more battle scarred, Mike. And in Israel, everything is close. But imagine the January 6th Capitol riot being held instead of people wandering in cluelessly. Into the Capitol, they would have been carrying torches and threatening to...
Well, according to our mainstream media, that is what happened.
So imagine there were actual pictures of people with torches going to threatening to kill Mike Pence.
Well, there was. What do they call him? The shaman, the MAGA shaman. He had the horned. What was he carrying? A sword or a spear?
A spear. Viking's head.
Yeah. So,
but you know that you look from the mainstream media, and from where I look, I see Ray Epps, not the shaman.
Yeah.
And also, I read Julie Kelly. So my perspective is very different. But this, you know, people are talking about incitement in the days before the Rabin assassination. We talked about this.
Yeah.
This is an attempt to actually break into the Prime Minister's office. Remember that on our last show, we showed
they had a map.
How to penetrate Caesarea. And there, and if you listen to their escalating rhetoric, then Netanyahu is the devil incarnate. And so And so the rhetoric is preparing the ground for a, you know, political theology, for an apocalypse.
Although you have here Ronen Barr.
The head of the FBI equivalent. Taking a strong stand by whispering something.
But it's interesting that he had to take a stand, though, isn't it? I mean, they are sending a signal that this is a step too far, no?
But they're not. I think they've already released them from custody.
Uh-huh.
I'm betting none will be indicted. If this were and in the meantime, I don't know if you know, but in the settlement of Yitzhar, there are people detained under matzar minhali. What do you call it?
Administrative detention.
Administrative detention without trial. One of them for collecting the names of suspected terrorists. So they cooperate with the settler violence campaign, and they stop innocent people for months and months. And now you have people breaking into the prime minister's office. Now, Mike, you know Israel well enough that if I ask you to imagine some kippah wearing with peyos. Payas, would you say in American English?
I think payas. Yeah, as a non-Jew, I don't know all the...
You're an honorary Jew. We consider you an honorary
you
Jew.
Say tzitzin?
Tzitziot. Tzitzi is not for this show.
Yeah, I apologize. See, look what happened to me.
So
wow, that got... At least maybe somebody giggled at that. We won't tell them what I just said.
So imagine the settlers trying to break in Yair Lapid's home. It will be, there would be sirens all over, and they would get 20 years in jail. And now the funny thing is, and it's not verified, but I just saw it on Twitter. So I'll give this for my dumbest take, and I'll give it away now. There was a small spontaneous demonstration outside the home of Gali Barav Miara, who's the attorney general, who's too lax on these people. These are, for Israelis, it's completely obvious that there are two states. This is the two-state non-solution. There's the master race, which is the Kaplan, Ashkenazi, rich elite, and then leftist, and then there's the right, which is exposed in a different way to the law. And they can do anything, and nothing will happen to them. But this little demonstration outside the attorney general, it said on Twitter, I don't know if it's verified, that each one of them got a 1,000 shekel fine. Mm. While these idealists from Achim LaNeshek who were threatening to break into the prime minister's office, residence, got
is
nothing.
It Achim LaNeshek?
No, I don't know. It's not Achim LaNeshek.
You're using it as
a metaphor. Yeah. We call it the Neture Kaplan. this will be a joke hard to explain. Why don't you try?
Neturei Karta is with guardians of the what? What is Karta?
Karta is card, but it's a scroll, I think.
The guardians of the scroll, which is I mean, guardians of the tradition.
A very, very extreme.
Anti-Zionist, ultra-Orthodox
sect.
Whenever you see demonstrations of ultra-Orthodox Jews together with Iranians saying that that Zionism is an abomination, these are guys from Neturei Karta.
So Neturei Kaplan is now an accepted... an accepted joke, but they tried.
It is very funny.
They tried to break into the prime minister residence, and what was scary, there was also a speech.
And Netorei means guardians, right?
Yeah, but
I'm sorry, I'm still back on the joke. But what? I'm just trying to figure out how far the joke goes. What does Karta mean? It means card, but what card?
I think it means scroll, but I'm not sure. You're taking.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm on shaking grounds. But there was also a speech by someone who claimed to be in the former bodyguard unit of Netanyahu himself, and he was bad-mouthing Netanyahu and his wife and everything. And then there were various calls for this squad that protects Netanyahu to stop doing it. These were Twitteratis, but no one is looking for them and no one is chasing them. And the Shabak, the Israeli Security Service, the Shin Bet, as English speakers still say, has a Jewish division. Mm-hmm. Which monitors settlers, but they do nothing when a right-wing
Kaplan.
Prime minister is under serious threat. And these people if they're not attempting to actually harm him, they are deliberately trying to scare these his family to death, and that is very, very frightening.
Okay, so let me ask you a question now. Let me bring up one other issue, and then ask a question about all this. The other day, or might have been yesterday, actually, Avigdor Lieberman, who is the most anti-religious, anti-ultra-Orthodox politician in Israel, or one of the most, and he's made it part of his whole program. He complained publicly, or he criticized the demonstrators, Achim Lanesek. Achim Lanesek?
Yeah, I think it was Achim
Lanesek. I'm messing up the Hebrew.
Brothers and sisters in arms.
Is it Achim Lanesek or Achim?
Achim Lanesek.
So they held a big protest in Mea Shearim, an ultra-Orthodox neighborhood. There's nobody but ultra-Orthodox there, and they went there and protested, and there were clashes between the ultra-Orthodox and Achim Lanesek. And Avigdor Lieberman came out in defense of the ultra-Orthodox and said, but what he said was interesting. He said that this protest was counterproductive. It only strengthened Bibi. Yeah. And of course, the point is to topple Bibi, so why are you doing this? But it was funny to me. It was amusing to see Avigdor Lieberman saying, "Leave
the defense."
Yeah, coming to the defense of the ultra-Orthodox. But now here's my question. From my sense of Israelis, I think Israelis don't like violent protest. As general, there's something in the Israeli public. They want a debate, even fierce, open debate, and there's nothing wrong with having a protest, but violent protest crosses a line in the public, and I think maybe have we reached a point here with the Kaplan people where this is
It's interesting that you ask, because there's an argument in our circles, I should say, in the
conservative circles
in Israel, but in the sector that is immersed in the day-to-day Twitter fights. And some have been criticizing us in the media, myself, Erez Tadmor, people you know who are conservative radio personalities and TV personalities, that we have given into the trap of unity that the Achim Lanesek have laid for us. And that we should have realized from the first moment that they have not given up the fight and they'll be as vicious as they were before. And it was my argument, in line with what you say, that we should let them start the acrimony and remain ourselves calm and collected, because the general public would not be sympathetic to wild demonstrations in a time of war. So one thing to say is it's a very small faction. You said thousands of people, that's the media spiel. Around the Knesset, they say there were hundreds and hundreds of tents. Apparently, according to the largest estimate, there were 800 tents. In each tent, two people. They were supposed to park around the Knesset for tens of thousands of people will lay a siege to the Knesset until the government collapses. So there are 1,600 people at most who are laying this siege. Now that's in electoral term, that's nothing and nobody. And I'm giving you the most generous estimate of what was going on there. Other estimates say people strolled around, many of the tents were just empty. Uh-huh. They just bought a lot of tents because they have a lot of money. Uh-huh. And so people are not going to be sympathetic in the long run.
To protest
in the midst of war?
I didn't fully understand. You said that you people like you are being criticized from voices on the right for falling into the trap, the unity trap that people like Achim Lanesek have set for you. In what way are you supposed to have fallen into a trap?
Well, I'll tell you who did fall into the trap. People who began cooperating with him, like, as usual, settler rabbis who are extremely naive, and they keep doing the same trick to them. And this is what ends with a Naftali Bennett phenomenon. That ends with the creation of some moderate party which would be annexed to the left-wing bloc by seduction, because what happened with the settlers is extremely interesting. They began, remember, if you're an historian, and an historian of the Middle East, and so the traditional, maybe I should say classic format of the coalition in Israel used to be Mapai, the labor Zionism, with the religious Zionist party.
Right.
So these were two forms of the same elite. And then after 67, when the religious National Religious Party was overtaken by the vision of Rabbi Cook and began the project of the settlement, there was a rift between labor and the settlers. And they feel ever since that they were banished from the circle of light. And now many of them had to go and rub shoulders with the Likud Mizrahi working class, which some of them considered deplorable. So there's something that plays.
So there's a desire. I did not. This kind of makes sense. So there's a desire within some segment of the religious nationalist community for legitimacy
from the left.
From the left. From the elite.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that, of course, exists in the American right too.
I think it's a west-wide phenomenon, but there's also
because they own the legitimacy.
There's also there was also a, I think this has been running for.
Sorry, explain to me as an historian of the United States. That's you. Why do they have this ability to confer legitimacy, and why does the left have that? Where does that come from?
Well, shall we go back to William Jennings Bryan or all the way to Andrew Jackson?
Okay.
I think the question you first have to answer is why intellectuals tend to the left, and then ask, because intellectuals would have the power to confer legitimacy, and that always creates a tension in democracies, right? Because Because in a democracy like the United States or like ours, in order to legitimize elitism, you needed to be professionalism. So progressivism, before it was a new label for the woke, was once the label for professional scientific management of government, from which democracies now progressively suffer.
Uh-huh.
But you're an admirer of Andrew Jackson, are you not?
Yes, I am. He's my favorite president.
And why is that?
First of all, I find his life on. This is another. So why are we talking about this? Let's talk.
Because it's interesting.
You sucked me into
that. So finish that. Finish that paragraph.
No, look, he's one of the. He's actually one of the founders of the country.
Yeah,
but we don't think of him as a founder because he came decades later, but the modern presidency is Andrew Jackson, and Andrew Jackson's populism appeals to me.
Yeah,
I come from a Jacksonian family.
Oh, no,
which is not to say I learned this from my colleague Walter Russell Mead. Mm-hmm. Because he has developed this idea of Jacksonianism as a strain in American political thinking. I think the historians, they end the Jacksonian era, but the fact of the matter is that there's a whole segment of the country that continues to have kind of Jacksonian sense, but it's not a formal tradition, and they don't associate the attitudes that they have with Jackson.
It's a persuasion.
It's a persuasion, yeah. It's the title of a famous book.
You're listening to Israel Update, where you will learn about early American history.
About the Jacksonian persuasion. Yeah, I learned from reading Walter Russell Mead and talking to him that the attitudes that I grew up with at home were totally Jacksonian, and they make sense to me.
And they're relevant, and I think they're relevant in Israel, too, because we have just been through a struggle between democracy and elitism, where elitism was pretending to be democracy. That was the struggle.
That's what's going on here. That's what's going on here too. Same thing. And they make me sick.
And all
in my gut, they make me sick.
all over
my people, the educated class into which I have
stumbled accidentally.
Yeah,
it's going on all over the West, and I think there's something to be said. Maybe you should talk about it on one of our episodes about how judiciaries serve to undermine democracies. America is actually the odd one off here, because what is happening in Israel is happening in Europe, where legislation moves out of the hands of elected bodies into judiciaries, which by interpretation actually create the law and create states. This is what's happening with the European Union. So, but back to Achim LaNeshek, what I was going to say about when rabbis from the settler movement go to these meetings with them, and in which I think they actually fall into a trap. They're answered with this meme on Twitter of the Gollum. You know it from the Lord of the Rings. There's this monster called
Gollum.
Gollum. It's Golem.
Gollum is from the Jewish tradition. Yeah.
I think he borrowed.
Oh, I'm sure he did. Yeah. So, but they pronounce it Gollum.
So on the upper picture, you see him with his teeth out saying, Saturday in Kaplan, you will have no army. And then in the bottom picture, he has wide eyes and he said, do you want us to help you pick up tomatoes? So this is how the trap works. And I think it is a trap. But I don't think that the we I'm referring to, whatever that is.
Just so everybody understood, you want us to help pick tomatoes. We're talking about all the volunteers who went, when everyone went to war, as a sign of national unity, the volunteers went to the fields.
Achim LaNeshek supplied the army with the equipment that they have a lot of money, so they supplied meals, but they had stickers on them, political stickers on them. So in some places, soldiers said told them to f off.
And this because, and it was and it became a it became a but it became a talking point in the mainstream media that. That the government after October 7th totally failed because it's a dysfunctional government, but civil society, meaning Achim LaNeshek, filled the breach.
That was their spin. It was not very convincing because the government did 95%
of the work. A lot of people have said that to me, though.
Yeah, a lot of people believe.
Some people were convinced.
Because you know the problem is they have the media, and the media has lost all pretense of an ethic of reporting and has replaced it completely with an ethic of educating if you are generous or indoctrinating if you are honest. Right. And they are willing to lie. Now in my mind, because you know my lifelong passion to fight against postmodernism is that it has to do with the postmodern turn in academia, because on the one hand the ethic objectivity is downgraded. There's no such thing as facts, so you have epistemological relativism. There's no truth. On the other hand, there's moral absolutism. These people know with absolute certainty what is good for you. So
love that about this postmodernism.
That they entertain both.
Yeah, if you make a statement, they counter it with relativism, but their dogmas are absolutely fixed.
But if you combine epistemological relativism with moral absolutism, you get a license to lie. That's what it amounts to.
Epistemological relativism with moral absolutism.
Yeah,
You know what it gives me? Ontological doubt.
Let's talk about German romantic idealism. So I'm not sure we have time to get into what I wanted us to discuss is and actually sympathetically. So maybe we can do this on our next show. And because I want to take off my armor. You know, I'm a, what do you call it?
A warrior?
A bar fighter? No.
Bar fighter?
You have a label for me in that I am an intellectual.
Yes, brawler.
Brawler. Okay. Yeah. So I'll leave aside my.
Just so people understand what we're saying. I when we're talking in private sometime, I tell you, you don't have to, just because somebody says they want to have a fight with you, doesn't mean you have to rush to go fight them.
Yeah, I beat intellectuals, only with ideas. Yes. So,
but so, you do love a fight. You find it very difficult to say no to a fight. If some idiot says something to you, you want to go punch him.
Unless it's physical.
Yes, no, I'm talking about intellectual
brawling. Don't forget that I'm short, relatively, and I don't start fights with tall people. But
you can run between their legs. And
I think,
pick them up.
I think. You started with Tsitsi, now this is going in a bad direction.
Okay.
But what I think about, what I have to say in defense of this, often I think you're right and I just am hot-blooded, but sometimes moderation is not the moral way to go. So sometimes you have to confront these people. Say for instance, the attempt to use the issue of the hostages in order to topple the government is a moral outrage. It should be called that. And these people, you should go on Twitter and fight them, not give in to their emotional extortion. But first of all, often you're right, and I get into fights with, you know, my friend Avi, who you know, said, why is that also your responsibility? Why is everything? But what I wanted to do is actually runs against.
You want to take off your armor
And try to sympathetically think why those people are in such hysteria. What is the source of the hysteria? I recently heard a politician from Yesh Atid speak. I seriously disliked what he had to say, but...
Is this something I also heard?
You might have, yeah.
Yeah.
I think you did. But you can sense that something really frightens him. He sees a great threat. Whenever he says Smotrich, whenever he says
Ben-Gvir,
and also when he says Netanyahu, something threatens him. And I think that we can explain that if we do it sympathetically. So
yes, well, he said it actually, because he said that they're coming for me.
Yeah.
They want to change me.
Yeah.
The way he sees the world, I can see we're getting into it now because I can see this is how I feel about progressivism. I actually see myself as a live and let live person. I think that's how I have conducted myself, and it's what I taught my children. You know, people are different than you. Let them do what they want to do as long as they're not going to do anything that's going to harm you and so on. And I believe that progressives will not, they don't believe in live and let live. They have to own everything, and they have to obliterate anyone who disagrees with them.
All that while talking about the importance of difference and otherness.
Yes. And that's a total lie, of course. They have, one of the things that they've done is they have monopolized the discussion of diversity.
Yeah,
and exercise. You know, they police the concept of diversity, so only their understanding of diversity.
You know,
is
the late Todd Gitlin, who was once briefly president of SDS, and then became a leftist intellectual associated with the dissent circles.
Most of the people listening to us don't know what SDS was.
Students for a Democratic Society in the 60s.
Radical anti-Vietnam protesters in the radical Marxist students.
He was not a Marxist, and these are the circles
let's say Marxist influenced.
Yeah, and these people are actually, many of them were anti-Marxist because these are the circles around which in the end, I think, gathered around Dissent, Michael Walzer, Irving
Howe. Right? Oh, they were all SDS?
Yeah, I didn't know that. No, Todd was a friend of Michael's, and I think he wrote there. And before he became, I always think of him in relation to the Onion, the beautiful Onion story, the satirical paper that had a story saying, liberal dies of outrage fatigue. And ever since George W. Bush was elected, Todd went that way. And I was his student, and he ended up not talking to me because I changed my views, and he wrote against me and other stuff. But he had a book called Twilight of Common Dreams. And in it, there's a line I'll never forget. He said, multiculturalism, this was the name of woke back then, multiculturalism is about everybody marching in lockstep while declaring their separate identity. And that's exactly it. It's a rainbow of one color, and it always was. And then they create the illusion of diversity. And you see this in our struggle over the court. The Naama Lazimi, who's a member of Knesset for the Labour Party, she has a law to diversify the court. And of course, all the lists of things, quotas she wants to protect are identity quota, not political. She wants everyone to have the same political
stance. Not diversity of ideas.
But different skin colors, different backgrounds, different orientations, you know, Arab, Israeli, ultra-Orthodox. However, they must all conform to the same dogma. So I think you're right about progressives,
but this is what the Israeli establishment feels, that they are the guardians of live and let live, and the religious extremists are coming to force their kids to be ultra-Orthodox Jews.
They are the guardians of live and let live, and therefore everyone else must die. You're pointing at the right title for this, but I think if we, you don't like the word, unpack this next time, I think there's a lot to be said, because I think, and I didn't think that during the protest, I think some of them, when they say, some of them wrapped themselves in the flag while they were voting for the Arab parties. It was just a show. Mm. But the others, and people like Yesh Atid, many of them see themselves as Zionists, but their interpretation of Zionism is a non-Jewish interpretation.
There's always been this strain in Zionism that we're gonna create a Jewish state so that we can be a people like all other people.
Exactly, and to be a people like all people for many of them is to turn your back on the Jewish story and the Jewish tradition. Mm. And therefore, the problem is not just Smotrich being, you know, messianic. The problem is that we provincial right-wing conservatives, religious, ultra-Orthodox, etc., we all are threatening to pull these Herodians back to the little Jewish smelly swamp. And they've emerge from that to breathe the air of the wide world to go to.
Oh, this is actually. There's a lot. I see. We should talk. This is very interesting.
Yeah.
There's a whole. There's lots of contradictory cross currents.
Absolutely.
From Zionist history.
Let's devote one of our episodes to this, because I think it's worth. It's worthwhile trying to understand them, because I'm not worried, because I think this elite is actually decaying and disintegrating, and this is the swan song. Do you say in English?
We say
in
the swan song. Yeah.
This is their swan song, and it's very wild.
You say it in Hebrew too?
Around.
What is the Hebrew?
Shirat HaBarbu.
Oh.
Nice.
Nice.
Huh?
Yeah. Very nice.
The famous satirical trio Agashash HaChiver had a I think it was
the funniest Israelis ever.
Shirat HaBirbur. Birbur is lebarber is to blah blah. Shirat HaBirbur. They had a record. Mike, we are off to your dumb mistake, because I think we're out of time.
I have to make one point and then the dumb mistake.
Sure.
I just want to make we can't let this strike in Damascus go without talking about this. It's so important. I want to say that it's extremely interesting, because it comes at a moment when, the United States is restraining Israel on the northern front and telling Israel not to escalate. So there's a violation of the Americans. There's a clear effort to go beyond the lines that the Americans are quietly setting behind the scenes, quietly but very demonstratively setting. And number two, it also comes at a moment when the United States has very demonstrably not attacked Iranians in response to all the attacks on, on U.S. and Israeli and international shipping by Iranian proxies. The U.S. has sent a very clear signal to Tehran that it's not going to touch any Iranians for that. So Israel has crossed the lines that the United States has set for it in the war in Lebanon, and it's shown that it is willing to kill
To cross the line that Americans set for themselves.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a lot more to be said about that, but I just want to we don't have time, but I just wanted to say that.
But we'll do it in one so that is more time bound, and I think we should in the next episode follow this, and then go back to the protest. Yeah.
My dumb mistake on the war. Again, we can do it very quickly because we're just repeating something that we've said in the past. But there's an Ofer Shelach in the Institute for National Security Studies (INSS). He wrote an article today.
He used to be Yair Lapid's deputy in Yesh Atid.
Yes, yes.
He challenged him in the primaries and was kicked out.
Ah, I did not know that. But he was in Yesh Atid. He's a former journalist. Now he's at INSS. INSS is the Brookings of Israel. That's not the greatest example, but it's the most prestigious think tank in Israel, and it is very closely associated with the IDF establishment. Is that fair to say?
And also with the American administration.
And yeah, and they're also in with the American, but and that's where it gets interesting, because what he argues here is stop this. The title of it, and this is in Yedioth Ahronot, is stop the small war to win the big war, and he says that the big war is the regional conflict with Iran, the small war is the war in Gaza. Netanyahu is trying to prolong the small war in Gaza indefinitely in order to stay in power. But what we really need is a prolonged ceasefire in Gaza so that we can work together with the Americans against the Iranians.
The trap you warn against.
It's all so clearly stated here. And this is, of course, what I have been saying, that Israelis are buying the notion that the administration is really trying to contain Iran. Israelis are buying it, and pro-Israelis in the United States, some significant segment of pro-Israelis are buying it. And the two things that get read in the pro-Israel circles in the United States as a clear sign that indeed Biden is trying to restrain Iran are the support that he has given so far to the Israelis in Gaza, A, and B, the work toward normalization with Saudi Arabia. Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, is on his way this week, I believe, if not this week, then next week, to Saudi Arabia. And the news is reporting that he's going to go to talk to Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince and de facto ruler, about normalization with Israel, before the election. And that's designed to reinforce this line. This is a line. We've heard this in the Israeli media. We've heard it from Ben Kaspit, Nahum Barnea. We've heard it in the United States from Tom Friedman, that this is what the administration is really trying to do. It has this grand strategy for containing Iran, but because Netanyahu will not get rid of Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and accept the Palestinian Authority in Gaza, then therefore there can't be normalization with Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia has put down as a condition that we have to have two-state solution in order for Saudi Arabia to normalize with Israel. And therefore, as the Ofer Shelach says, that Israel is going to find itself alone without the United States against Iran, because Netanyahu has this petty these petty political agenda.
That's their maneuver. We should talk about this in my Hebrew speaking podcast.
Okay.
Which we will.
Why are we talking about your Hebrew speaking podcast?
Because we want to know that there is competition to this podcast. Both of us are waiting there too.
There, you get the really good stuff. Here, we just tantalize.
This is just the promo.
Yeah.
The trailer.
For the really good stuff.
For the real 10-hour Hebrew podcast that we're going to record before I head out of Washington, D.C. Mike, thank you for hosting me at the headquarters of the Hudson.
You're always welcome at the headquarters.
I appreciate it. Thank
you. At the
HQ. Thank you for listening, and we'll be with you next week.